I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is Tech Central. Now, Joan Joffe is my guest in the next episode of TCS Legends. But before I introduce you to her, I must tell you that TCS Legends is powered by Mitel. For all your unified communications and customer experience needs, do visit them at mitel.com. Now, Joan Joffe is a very well-known figure in the local technology industry. She played a pivotal role in introducing personal computers into the South African market, including the original IBM PC. And she was also intimately involved in the launch of the cellular network Vodacom in South Africa, amongst many other ventures. So I'm really pleased to welcome her into the studio today, a real legend. Joan Joffe, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Great. Joan, I think many people might not know that you actually were at one stage a tech journalist. You were a writer for Finance Week, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I've worn a few hats in my time. I did write the technology section for Finance Week when I was sitting out in restraint of trade. And it was a very good way of keeping in the industry, but not actually breaking my restraint of trade.
Okay.
So it was an interesting time, and I learned how to be a journalist rather than to be interviewed by journalists.
All right.
I've seen it from both sides.
Okay. So when were you at Finance Week?
Gosh, it was in the early 1990s.
Yeah. Okay. So what was topical in the early 90s? Windows was just released.
Yes, and there was a lot of software, and it was before the internet. Yeah, it was very early days. I honestly can't remember.
Early days of the PC revolution.
PC.
DOS and Windows just come out.
That's right, yes.
Interesting times, yeah. So, Joan, let's look back at your very storied career. You studied at WITS, majoring in maths and philosophy. You had planned to be a lawyer like your dad, but the computer industry lured you in. How did that happen?
Well, it was two chance and wonderful chance for me that a friend of a friend, I was taking a year off between finishing my undergrad degree and doing law, and he said, well, if you've got nothing to do, come for an interview with a computer company. And there were no computers in those days, or I certainly didn't know about them, and I said, sure. I went for an interview, and I got a job as a computer programmer, which I didn't know what a programmer was either, but I learned pretty quickly. And it was very fortuitous for me because I absolutely loved it. Yes, I studied, my degree was philosophy, but the main section of it was logic. And programming is pure logic, and I love it. I loved it, and I was very lucky to get into the industry that way.
What were you programming on all the way back then?
Sure, it was ICL 1901.
What is that, a mainframe?
A mainframe, a real big one, in an air-conditioned room with artificial floors, and you needed a passport to get into the room. It was that kind of thing, and it was slow like anything. It used punch cards, which were really early days.
Yes.
And, that's how I started.
Punch cards were used for actually storing data, weren't they? Yeah. They were literally cards that were punched with information.
I mean, I programmed in binary. It had to be either a zero or a one.
Good grief.
And if you look at that, and if you make a mistake there, well, the whole thing's out.
Yeah.
So, you know, modern day languages, Python and all of that, I mean, that's easy. You just write.
Yeah.
But
so you had to write in machine code.
In machine code, in binary, yeah.
Wow. That must have been very time-consuming.
I suppose it was, yes.
Were you were you the only woman in the industry? I mean, it's historically been a very male-dominated industry. I know in the US there were a lot of women programmers involved in, for example, the moon mission at NASA.
Sure.
Were there other female programmers in South Africa?
Well, that NASA thing was much later. I mean, when I got
later.
Into the industry, when I got into the industry, it was unheard of that a woman was in any kind of job like that.
Oh, wow.
And it was fun. I mean, I was in the back room and I was coding and I was sort of fixing machines and that sort of thing. But when I got to the next stage of my career, then I was really the only woman. And I always say it was fantastic, actually, because, you know, what is marketing? It's all about differentiating yourself from everybody else. So there I was a woman. There were no other women in the industry. I never got refused an interview. I never got refused a sale, or hardly ever. Nobody ever swore at me. Nobody ever slammed the door in my face. So it was great. Yes, I was, I suppose, a pioneer. Yes, I was.
Yeah, yeah. And it's still quite male-dominated, even today.
Yes, although
it's changed a lot.
Yeah, it has changed a lot. Mm. And, yeah, there are a lot of women in the industry now.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not talking about programming, which there are a lot of women in programming.
Sure.
But I mean, generally, in the IT industry, there are a lot of very good people.
And, of course, during the course of your career, you went on to inspire a lot of women to choose careers in tech, and they still seek out your advice today. And we'll talk a little bit about that a bit later in the show. But let's look at those early days. I believe that one of the first projects that you were involved in as a programmer was a computerized payroll system for what was then SA Railways, today part of Transnet.
Yeah.
Tell us about that project.
Good. I mean, it was, when I think about it, it was a gigantic project. Of course, we had a team working on it, but mm-hmm. I was very involved and in the section that I was working, and it was a great learning experience. And I think in the end, the whole thing worked. The system worked, mm-hmm. which was remarkable. And, it was a great experience.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about the system that was developed. It was the first computerized system for payroll in the railways.
Yes, yes.
What did it allow the railways to do that it wasn't doing before?
Well, I suppose it allowed them to pay their salaried personnel
more efficiently.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, you know, when you think about it, how HR is today and payroll systems, I mean, it really was pioneering work.
Yeah.
Okay, I was only a section of that. I didn't write the whole section, but it was quite significant in its time.
Was it all paper-based before that?
Yeah, it was.
All manual paper-based processes.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And I guess a lot of that sort of computerization was going on in South Africa at that time,
with many
companies actually deploying computer systems for the very first time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it was a revolution from manual to computerized systems.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's been huge progress since then, but that was the first step.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You later got married, Joan, and you moved with your new husband to the U.S. Tell us about that adventure.
Well, that was wonderful. I mean, we got married, and my husband, Sharky, was studying at Stanford University.
Mm-hmm. That's in Silicon Valley?
Yes, in Palo Alto.
Which was probably quite underdeveloped back then.
Yeah, it was early days, and I was very fortunate. I also studied at Stanford. I studied computer science, which... coming from South Africa, the maths that I matriculated with, that I did my degree in, was kind of high school stuff for the kids,
for
the people at Stanford. I mean, it was very challenging, I must say, but it was a great experience. And and then we moved to San Francisco, mm-hmm. Where we both got jobs.
Okay, and this was in the 1960s.
1960s.
It must have been a fascinating time to be there. I mean, that was the height of flower power and the hippie movement, and Woodstock was coming.
Yeah. San Francisco was great. I mean, it was really a wonderful city. I don't know what it's like. I haven't been there back lately.
Oh, it's not as good.
No, it's not flower power anymore.
No.
It's more drug power,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
Oh, gosh. No, it was wonderful, and I mean, great experience. My first job there was with Wells Fargo Bank as a programmer, mm-hmm. Which was interesting. And then Wells Fargo was bought by Bank of America, so then I worked at Bank of America. And then I moved to Standard Oil of California, which was great. I mean, the experiences were fantastic, working with people there and in that area. Then I was a methods analyst. I moved up from being a programmer to being a methods analyst and spent a couple of years there, and then we came back to South Africa.
Okay. So when did you return?
It was about 1965, I think.
Oh, 65, okay. Yeah. So you left before the moon landing and all the rest of it.
Long before.
But what was the culture like in San Francisco in the 1960s? It must have been a fascinating time to be there.
No, it wasn't anything spectacularly different. It was a very cultured experience with a lot of good opera and theatre and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. music. And it was nice. It was nice to be there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And you took a job with IBM once you came back,
Yes, when I came back, I got a job with IBM as, I think I was a systems analyst by that time, And I remember they had downtown premises with a huge mainframe still, and it was now magnetic tape. So you had these huge rolls of magnetic tape that you had to fit in and then had to play. Gosh, it was so primitive. But anyway, it was nice to work for IBM. It was very nice.
So were you involved in client projects and that sort of thing for IBM?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you moved to HP.
Yeah. Also, fortuitously, a friend of a friend said, hey, why don't you come and work for Hewlett-Packard? Mm-hmm. Because they were just launching their desktop computers, which were... I would desktop accounting machines, basically. So went
grown up calculators, basically.
Well, yes. So I went for that interview, and the CEO, I think he was at the time, said, oh, look, you know, Joan, it's a very long selling cycle between trying to sell the desktop computer and the order coming through. He said, why are you waiting that out? Why don't you try selling our new HP calculators, which we're just launching. Mm-hmm. So this was an offer to sell, which I'd never done. Mm-hmm. I'd always been programming, enjoying being quiet and loving the technology and loving the logic of it all. I said, okay, yeah, why not? And then, I mean, that was pure luck because I joined HP and they had offices in Bromfontein on the second floor. The building, mm-hmm. and they launched the HP 35 calculator, which was revolutionary in its time.
I even remember that one.
Can you? Okay.
I think my dad might have had one, actually.
Anybody in engineering, surveying...
He was an engineer.
...technology, anything. You had to have an HP calculator. Mm-hmm. So my first sales call was with an HP 35, I think it was, to a gentleman called... On the East Rand.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name. But I was so nervous the night before I was going to his office that my husband and I role played. He was the customer and I was selling. And he said, well, you know, this is how it works and this is what you do. So I get to, his name was Mr. Murphy. Mm-hmm. So I get to Explosive Engineering on the West Rand somewhere. And I get to his office and big desk, I remember, and I'm sitting there and I take out the calculator and I say, you press this button to get the sine and this button to get cosine and this is what... And he said, no. He said, I don't want to know how it works. How much is it? Mm-hmm. And I said, whatever it was. And he took out his checkbook and he wrote a check and gave me the check and he took the calculator. That was my first ever sale, and it just carried on like that.
They were quite expensive devices, weren't they? I mean, it's not like the calculator you buy at the local spa today.
They were well into the 1,000 rands and something.
That day's money. Yeah.
And, I mean, then the HP 35, the HP 45, the HP 65, the HP 99. I mean, they were amazing tools. And if you needed that kind of thing, you had to have them. Mm-hmm. So... You know, I used to load up my car, the boot, these boxes of HP calculators. I used to leave early in the morning, go East Rand, West Rand, North, South, because I had the whole of basic Gauteng as my territory.
Yeah.
And I used to sell everything, come back with checks, load up for the next day. That was how to sell. Wow. I never sold a desktop computer, but I sold thousands of calculators.
And did you become comfortable doing that? I mean, you were nervous on the first sale. Did you eventually become comfortable?
Oh, it was so easy. I mean, these things sold themselves. And we were the office was near that, just two blocks away. And I did a deal with the engineering bookshop at Wits, where all the engineering students used to buy their supplies, and I supplied them. And a lot of them didn't have enough money to buy a calculator being students, so brought Nedbank in, and Nedbank did a deal with these young engineers, which I'm sure they're still Nedbank customers. And it was when stock arrived, it's unbelievable. We were on the second floor of the building in Bromfontein. There used to be queues down the step, around the block, around the corner and back again in order to get the HP calculator. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how to sell books.
Yes.
That was fantastic.
Yes.
Because they had, you know, they'd ordered and they had a list and they came to get the calculator. So that
fantastic.
Was phenomenal.
And you stayed in the HP ecosystem for some time. In fact, wasn't that when you first struck out with your own business as an HP agent in Joburg, the sort of origins of what became Joffe Associates?
Yeah, no, that's what happened. Well, I mean, look, I had the whole territory. They didn't appoint somebody for further north, and that upset me a bit because why should I share my territory? But anyway, I did. And then they decided it was time to set up a dealer network, and they offered me a dealership. So I took the dealership and for HP calculators, and that's how I started my business. And what I call it, and I had no experience in running a business, what I call it, Joffe Associates. Mm-hmm. That's how it started. And I started with an HP calculator dealership.
Okay.
You know, working from home with my boot again, mm-hmm. selling calculators. And then other products came along, and I took agencies for those. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a very simple philosophy, sell for more than you buy for. And it worked very well for me. And that's how I started the business, yeah.
Great. So take us through how it grew from there, how you eventually came to represent IBM in South Africa and the story of the introduction of the original IBM PC into the local market.
Well, it was a great story. I mean, when I think back on it, I don't know how I did it or why I did it, but I did it. Started selling calculators from my boot from home, and then business got quite busy, and I needed an office because people wanted to come mm-hmm. to me. So my husband's engineering firm were on the 18th floor of Penmore Tower in downtown Johannesburg, and the partner said very nicely, sure, we can give Joan an office. She can run her little business from there. Mm-hmm. So I set up my business there, and then customers started coming up 18 floors to the office, and there were queues again. I mean, it sounds like I was doing the selling, but actually it was the product.
Yes.
It was the product. And so eventually the engineering partner said, well, look, it's very simple. Either we're moving out or Joan's moving out. So I had to move. And it was quite terrifying to think that I had to now get a place of my own, pay rent and have staff and ensure that the coffee was there if people wanted coffee and who was going to clean the place. Anyway, got very nice premises. My husband is really remarkable. He found ground floor premises on the corner of Fox and Harrison Street, mm-hmm. which was key financial area.
Right.
The banks were around there. Anglo-American was nearby, insurance company. So there I was, now running a business that had premises.
In the financial district.
And then the shop became a mecca. I mean, people used to come in there. Okay, so I'm a little ahead of myself. After IBM, after the HP calculators became Radio Shack and Atari and then Apple. And Apple launched in South Africa, and I got an agency. I got a distributed agency for Apple, and there was Apple 2C, which was little screen and then a keyboard, which was also revolutionary in its time. And
a lot of those were sold into schools.
Yes, yeah, they were very, very good in education. And so then, with that and other products and HP, and the Joffe Associates became a mecca. At lunchtime, the place was full of people, and they were playing with the Apple and playing games and this and that and other. So business was great.
You're a bit like the original Incredible Connection, right?
Well, yes. I could have been the Incredible Connection if I wanted to, if I continue afterwards. Anyway, so it became very busy and very nice. And I had staff by then, and we had some amazing people who are still very close to me. And then there was an organization called the Transvaal Amateur Computing Club, TAC, I think it was called. And I was a member. And one day I went to a meeting, and they spoke about this, that IBM was going to launch a small computer. And I just said, okay, that's going to be something big. And I came back to my office, and I called up IBM to the CEO, and I asked for an appointment. And I got an appointment with Jack Clark. IBM offices were opposite the Carlton Center. Mm-hmm. And I went and I had this, I was shown into Jack Clark's office, and he was a big man. He sat here, and I sat there. And he said, Mrs. Joffe, what can I do for you? And I said, well, Mr. Clark, I see that IBM are launching a desktop computer in America, and I would like to be an agent for them in South Africa. And he got up off his chair and he came over to me and he said, Madam, IBM is a mainframe company. We will not be selling the IBM PC in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And he showed me to the door. And, well, I was fortunate. I had a brother who lived in the US and got on a plane and I went and I stopped. He met me at the airport. Stopped at the first Computerland store that we passed. I got out. Fortuitously, there was a very nice woman who was running the shop. I said, I'd like to import IBM PCs into South Africa. And she said, sure. How many do you want? There were no exchange control, no licenses, nothing. So I brought IBM PCs into South Africa.
Through Computerland?
It was a Computerland shop.
Yes. Okay. And how many did you bring in initially?
I brought in 10.
10.
And they arrived, and my technical man, Carlo Pagani, who is fantastic and who was one of the mainstays of my business, we unpacked these computers, and we had to fit in the memory chips onto the PC board by hand, and sometimes they twisted and broke, and it was quite dramatic. Anyway, we got them working, mostly. And started to sell IBM PCs. And we were in this wonderful location, and we put up a banner outside the building, the front door, IBM PCs available here. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if people had come before, you can imagine. And it was a small area. It wasn't a big shop. So, you know, that's how we started. And IBM were not at all happy. They didn't like it.
I'm sure.
So they sent their lawyers to me and said, look, you can't put up that banner. You're using the IBM logo. It's not allowed. So we took the banner down, just changed the logo a little bit and put it back up again. Mm-hmm. And that was that. Anyway, I mean, this was really interesting what happened. So we, in the process of setting up these PCs and the ones that came afterward, some of them we didn't get it right and we blew some of them and we didn't have enough parts. So I called up Jack Clark and I said, Mr. Clark, it's Joan Joffe here, Mrs. Joffe here.
You knew who you were formal. Now, I'm sure.
Yes, and I could hear him standing up. I said, you know, I'm selling these computers and they've got IBM on the front. And there was a kind of like a silence. And I said, and we need some help repairing them. And I could hear him standing and shouting, Madam, you brought them in, you fix them. So, and then he put the phone down. It was still a phone in those days. So we managed. We got parts, we fixed them. And IBM, they didn't like it at all. But anyway, eventually, I think it didn't take very long, maybe 3-4 months. They decided, look, they better also start selling IBM PCs. So they ordered an IBM PC from me at Joffe Associates.
From you, okay.
That was the best sale I've ever made. They needed it in order to teach their people how to all about the IBM PCs. So, yeah, so that was the IBM story.
Did you ever have a formal relationship with IBM?
Oh, yes. Oh, no. Then they appointed me a dealer. I was the first dealer. And I was the best dealer, I promise you.
Okay.
I was very well established. And because I was running a business and it was become very competitive. Mm. So I started this unheard of thing called discounting. So if my competitors were selling at X, then I would sell at X minus something. Mm-hmm. And IBM did not like that. That was not the IBM way. So they sent their team of bully boys this time. And they sat around my desk and they said, you're not allowed to do that. We've got a recommended selling price and you stick to that. I said, oh, okay. And I just carried on doing what I was doing. Anyway, I did start a huge price war. And I don't know if it was good or bad, but I sold plenty of computers.
Right. How many did you sell, do you think, in the end?
I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know. Hundreds,
Was it your most lucrative business, or were there other products that also?
No, there were a lot of other products that came on. I mean, IBM really established Joffe Associates as the place to buy anything. And, you know, used to get, we had a P.O. box at the main post office in Rissick Street. And box 10344. Used to go there on a Sunday. I mean, used to get the post every day, but on a Sunday, used to go there with really a bag like this and pick up the mail. And then I used to sit the whole day, and my family, my kids used to open the envelopes and whatever. Orders and checks and whatever. And it was a fabulous, fabulous business.
So how did it, what happened next? I mean, you eventually sold the business. Tell us, take us through what happened prior to the sale, how you built it up, the IBM years, what came after that, and then the eventual sale to DataCore.
Well, I mean, business just grew. It just grew, and it was phenomenal, and it was highly successful, but it really took up my time. I had no partners. I had a fabulous team of people who were dedicated, and we were like a family. But it was, I got too involved in the business, and had a family, two young kids, husband, and it just became too much. And one day I realized, you know, I can't carry on like this. So at the time, the company was very well known, and I got approached by, I got several approaches to sell the company. One was from somebody who actually wanted me to go to Australia to set up computer shops around throughout Australia, and I turned that down. And you know, eventually there were a lot of offers, but eventually this company DataCore made an offer to me, and they were about to list on the JSE, and it just made a lot of sense. They were a technology company; I was I needed them; they needed me. So I sold the business to DataCore, and followed then the most unhappy few years of my life. As I left my wonderful team of people in our downtown premises to move to DataCore's head offices, where I didn't fit in, where I didn't feel comfortable in the corporate environment, in that corporate environment. And it was very unpleasant.
Who did DataCore own? I remember the name. Weren't they an investor in Dimension Data? Or am I
There was a company called Mercedes Data.
Mercedes Information Data. Technology.
Yes. And then they changed their name to DataCore. And
but there was a Dimension Data link.
No, Dimension Data link. Okay. No, not at all. Okay. And then they listed, and it was a brilliant listing, 100% oversubscribed, and hey, it was great. You know, I was in this situation, but I was very unhappy, very unhappy. And eventually I resigned. I didn't even go through a process of, you know, negotiations when I left. I just, and they ruined the Joffe Associates business. They put in people who were nothing like me, and my staff, it didn't work. And it just, business just collapsed. And it was very unfortunate. And then when I left, I had signed a 2-year restraint of trade, which was very onerous and very unpleasantly handled by the CEO. It really was awful. I couldn't go into any kind of business where there was PCs or related. So that's when I went into journalism.
Okay. So it was your gardening leave.
Yes.
Okay.
And I also started another business called JNet, which was using X24 communications. It was just before the internet. So in order to get information from one place to another, you had to get it there somehow. So this company, we had the technology, which I bought, which I didn't buy, but I licensed to do that. And I was told that I need a license to use this network, which was complicated. So I got an appointment at Telkom to discuss this, and I was introduced to Alan Knott-Craig, who was working at Telkom, and I remember so clearly, I explained to him what I was doing, and please, can you help me get a license from Telkom? And he said, "Ugh, you don't need a license, just do it."
Which, that sounds like Alan.
Which was very Alan, and I just did it. And so I got, and it was quite a successful business, JNet, and it was just for the internet. So the internet would have killed the business. It did kill the business. But somebody made me an offer to buy that business, and I said, okay, let me sell it. And poor guy, I don't know what happened to him after that, but the business, it didn't survive the internet. So then, so that was my next step. And then also, then at that time, I got a call from a recruitment agency. He said, would I come to an interview with a company that's going to be launching cellular technology? What was cellular technology in 1993? I didn't actually know. I don't think anybody knew.
Except for Alan.
Alan was recruited by the shareholders to start Vodacom. But I didn't know that. Anyway, I went for this interview with Alan, not Craig, and it was very easy. He said, you know, do you think you can work with a person like me? He said. And I said, yeah, I think I can.
What was your first thought about him? What came into your mind when you first met Alan?
No, I thought, well, that's very nice. I was used to job interviews. I've had plenty of them, and this was a nice guy, and it sounded like an interesting business. I didn't know what cellular was, and I didn't know. He told me, well, look, we've got offices in Pretoria, which didn't suit me, because I'd have to travel to Pretoria. But I thought, okay, look, you know, I'll give it a go. Small company, startup, interesting technology, nice. It doesn't affect my restraint of trade, which was over by that time. Yeah, let me give it a go. So then I did, and I started work, and I started work on the 2nd of January 1994.
Okay.
And I thought, small company, no problem. And then I was hit by this avalanche of what was coming. I mean, there was advertising, marketing, service providers, shops, SIM cards, distribution. I mean, this just all hit me. And I thought what was a small business was going to be gigantic, which it is. But in the early days, I mean, we were very, I'd say, ambitious. We thought when we get to 50,000 people on the network, and we had a party. We had a party at the Sandton Sun with Alan and all of us, and we had a praise singer who came running in his gear and saying, you know, yeah, whatever. Look what Vodacom is doing, 50,000 customers. And today I think there are 50 million locally and 103 million through Africa.
So. Well, the original business plans, if I recall correctly, from both MTN and Vodacom suggested the market size was 200,000.
Something like that. I mean, can you believe what's happened? I mean, everybody. I mean, it was unique. If you had a cell phone, boy, you were really somebody in those days.
So what was Vodacom like in those first couple of years? It must have been quite a manic place.
It was manic. I mean, I think I never was particularly overweight, but I think I lost a fortune of weight. I was haggard. It was so exciting, so dramatic. I mean, for example, I was in charge of advertising. And when I arrived at Vodacom, there was an ad agency already installed by Rembrandt. There was an agency involved already. And they were based in Cape Town. And we had to launch in about 3 months from there. And they would come up to Johannesburg for a meeting to discuss the advertising, and they would sit in my office, and we would discuss it, and they say, look, we have to go, we have to catch a plane. Okay, we'll catch a later plane, and we catch a later plane. They never, in the time that I was there, agreed to move their offices to Johannesburg, which was the most stupid thing. So just before the launch, I said to Ellen, look, I can't work with these people. And Rembrandt, at that time, they were shareholders, they said, look, we've got an agency Lindsay Smithers, let's put them in and let's at least get going. And that was a wonderful thing because that was a great relationship, which has lasted at Vodacom until quite recently. And, you know, the early day advertising was scary, but it was fun.
It was very memorable. I think everyone remembers Michael Pinner, and there was Michael De Pinner, I think it was, and Professor, I forget his name.
Pankoli Omotoso.
Yes.
So, so the first ad that Lindsay Smithers came with, and I was sitting in the boardroom with Alan and a few other people, and they show this ad with a black man, professor of English, Omotoso, we didn't know that at the time, sitting there with a little wire windmills, and this white guy with a ponytail and his girlfriend getting out of the car. And, you know, how much are they? And slams the car door and eventually he can't open his car. So Omotoso says, hello, Vodacom. And, you know, when we saw this ad, I mean, it was 1994 and you didn't have that kind of relationship between us. I said, no, we can't possibly run that ad. I said, no, please, look, we'll put a translation underneath. We'll say, Yebo Gogo, hello, grandmother. Anyway, ran the ad, and it was phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. Now those ads are iconic. I mean, everyone remembers them, even today, 25 years.
Absolutely.
30 years later.
Yeah, and I mean, another memorable one was we had a whole series of ads where when you're choosing a cellular network, make sure that you choose one big enough to support you. So we had a sumo wrestler sitting on a chair and the chair broke. We had a huge dog with a little kennel next to it.
I remember that.
And that kind of ad. And then the competitions advertising agency said, no, you can't do that. Anyway, those are the kind of things. And it was hugely competitive. I mean, MTN, it was a scramble nearly to the death to get a customer. Because once you've got a customer and he got his number, you were unlikely to change your number. I mean, not many people. I suppose today you can port numbers, but in those days, if you got your number, that was it. Like your bank account, you stayed with that.
That scramble, I mean, Vodacom is the biggest mobile operator in South Africa today, probably because of that initial period where you signed up those contract lines.
Yes, and also, I mean, Alan was so, he had such vision. I mean, unbelievable. He, in the very early days where cell phones were rare, he said, we are going to cover the national roads. Now, if you think about it, where's your market? Your market is in the financial or the cities.
City. Yeah.
Why cover the national roads? He said, we're covering the national roads. And Vodacom did. We put coverage. So everybody was traveling to the Cape for the holidays or to Durban for business or whatever, they had to be on Vodacom because MTN didn't have that. So anyway, it was hugely competitive, and I was in the midst of this competition. I mean,
you had a colleague at MTN who Jacques Shelshop.
Jacques Shelshop,
he was kind of in the similar role to you at MTN.
Yes, we were bitter enemies. I mean, in the end, we were good friends, but in the beginning, I mean, he was really cheeky. He got a blimp with said MTN the better connection, and he flew it across my window.
That's hilarious.
And that kind of thing, you know, it was really, I mean, and we had time tests, and I think MTN crooked on the time test. But it was fun.
It was ugly.
It was very ugly, but it was fun. It was good. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And I remember the National Roads. I remember when that was announced, and then MTN followed you quite soon after because they had no choice.
Well, they had to, but we got in first.
Mm. And today, still today, if you drive down the National Roads, you'll see a Vodacom tower next to it, an MTN tower.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay.
If you go to Durban, there's two towers every so often. There's two towers.
Yeah.
And those were built in the mid-90s, yeah.
Yeah, right. And Alan was, I mean, he was just phenomenal as running the company. It was just amazing. And he took it personally. I mean, if a customer would phone and say, I'd keep dropping a call somewhere, wherever, he'd take me basically by the hand and say, come, show me where. Mm-hmm. And we'd go, and then he'd call his engineering and say, look, we need coverage over here. That's the way he ran the business, like it
really
was his own, you know, really hands-on.
Those road tests, or war drives, or whatever you want to call them, they did in the early days. I remember chatting to Peter Ace, you would go on to take the reins at Vodacom from Alan.
Yes.
And he told me about how they would drive all over the place,
yes.
Testing signal and
yes.
and feeding back to the engineers.
Exactly.
It's unusual to see that sort of involvement by a CEO.
Sure. No, it was amazing. I mean, that was how the company was built. Mm. And that's the basis for how it is today. And
yeah.
it's got, I think, the same ethos and the same hands-on. Well, that's yeah. big hands today.
Yeah. I guess he also had a free hand in that there was no controlling shareholder, effectively, in Vodacom in those days. He would play off Telkom against yeah. Vodafone. No,
that's right.
And ultimately would have what became Venfin guys working with him and siding with him on a lot of the stuff. So he actually got his way, even though his biggest shareholders didn't always agree with him.
Yeah, yeah. Look, Vodafone, I think, were great investors. I mean, they shared a lot of technology. They sent a lot of people out to work with us and a lot of trips to Vodafone. And Rembrandt, I know they put one of their top financial people in to run the finances in Vodacom. Which
was that Leon?
Leon Krauss, yes. And I mean, that was such a stable, amazing appointment.
Mm-hmm.
So Alan had good shareholders and he had good people. Mm. And that's how the business was so good, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it grew rapidly. Tell us about some of the more memorable events that you recall from that time and some of the events. Meeting Mandela. Tell us about that.
Well, it was 1994, and the ANC government was there, and everybody was scrambling to be on good terms.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great because we met people, and it was very nice. Mm. Anyway, one day I was driving to work on the freeway, and I got about halfway, and I got a call from Alan, and he said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm on the freeway." He said, "Well, turn around and go to Mr. Mandela's house, President Mandela's house. You're there for breakfast." So, okay. So I got off the freeway. I couldn't say no. How could I say no?
No.
So I went to Mandela's house, and there was a security outside. They were expecting me, opened the door, go inside. There's President Mandela and wonderful, warm, very nice, a few other people there, Jeremy Ord from Dimension Data, a few other guys. And we sat around Mandela's breakfast table, and we had breakfast, and we chatted. And after breakfast, and he was very friendly, mm-hmm. and after breakfast he went round the table, and I was the first one, and he said, "You, Vodacom, I want a school and a clinic in Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
And Dimension Data, you do this, you do that, you do that, you do that." Okay, yes, sure.
So, I can't say no.
So, no, anyway, so that was my introduction to him. And I went back to the office, and the next day, I was called to go on a helicopter with Stella Sekau, who was a minister of something or other, and to go to the Transguard to land to meet the chief of the area there to show us where Vodacom had to build, which we did. I mean, that was Mandela's wonder. He knew how to get to people. He knew how to ask. And it was a great relationship. And, I mean, I met him many, many times after that, and he always embraced me because I think that he actually saw a dollar sign embroidered on my forehead. That's not fair, but anyway, sure. I was in that position where we had a nice amount of money to give to charity, which we did. And that was the beginning of the Vodacom Foundation, which was very honored to be the first chairperson of the Vodacom Foundation. And it's a great organization. It was early days of charity, CSO, and it's done wonderful work, and I'm very proud. One of the proudest things I am of is the fact that I was there right at the beginning.
Of the Vodacom Foundation. What are some of the most memorable projects you can remember that the foundation was involved in?
Gosh, well, I mean, there were many. There were education, school projects, and in the beginning, I mean, there were so many requests. You know, you can imagine everybody, every entity wanted money, wanted a donation. And, I mean, the lines used to get flooded, and eventually, I was only in that position for a year before I left Vodacom, but eventually that decided on health, education, security, and I'm not sure what the other one was, but that was the focus. And I think it's even refined today, more refined. Mm-hmm. It had to be. I mean, you couldn't cope otherwise.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So how long were you with Vodacom for? When did you eventually leave, and why did you leave?
Why did I leave? I think you've got to know when it's enough, and I knew when it was enough. I actually resigned a few years before I left because I had a very nice offer from a women's empowerment group called Nazala, which was really a startup black women's empowerment group, and I could have gone there, and I was actually going to go there, and it was actually I was having a big birthday party. Oh, it was the opening of VodaWorld.
Oh yes.
The very first event was my birthday party. Okay, I'll tell you, I turned 60. Okay, and Alan said very generously, "Look, have your party at VodaWorld, and invite your friends. And by the way, we've got Vanessa May, the violinist. Mm-hmm. She's coming to give a concert, the first concert at VodaWorld. And Vodacom at that stage had just moved there, and VodaWorld was just open. And there was nothing around it. There were no buildings. Mm. It was isolated. And another vision, I mean, it was Alan's vision. That's where we're going to be. We're going to cover the national road. We're going to be in Midrand. We're going to do this. And he said, that's a week. Anyway, so he said, have your birthday party there and invite your friends. And so I invited friends to my birthday party, which Alan donated to me the whole birthday. And they said, but how can we go to this place? It's in the middle of nowhere. I said, no, look, it'll be worthwhile. Please come. So anyhow, so I had the party and I made my little speech and I thanked everybody and I thanked Alan and I said, I'm now going to be leaving, and I've had a wonderful time at Vodacom, and I'm joining my friends from Nazala who were there, and it was lovely, and the concert was amazing. The next day, I go in my office, and Alan comes and said, why do you tell people you're leaving? So I said, but you know I am leaving, Alan. I told you, I've resigned. He said, no, you haven't. So he cancelled my resignation. Oh, which, well, I don't know if it was a good thing, because if I had left at that point, I would have built another side of my life, but I didn't. And I'm very pleased in a way that I didn't, because I had a wonderful few more years at Vodacom, and then it was enough. And it was BEE, and there were lots of things on the horizon, and I went to Alan, and I said, Alan, it's time for me to go. And he said, okay. And he was very generous and, you know, gave me a consultancy for a year and... Mm-hmm. The kind of things you do with your executives when you're pleased with them. So that was the end of my career at Vodacom. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And do you stay in contact with Alan today?
Yes, I am. We exchange birthday greetings, and I haven't seen him for a number of years, but I hope he's well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Of course, he went on to lead Cell C, and he suffered a number of strokes over the years, actually starting at Vodacom, and his health.
Yes, that's right. His health took very sadly and unfortunately.
Took a turn, and everyone, I think, says now he probably shouldn't have taken the Cell C job. Yeah. But he did an amazing job at Vodacom, building it up into what it is today.
I think he's got a wonderful heritage. Mm. He's very well respected and loved by everybody who worked with him. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do post-Vodacom?
Okay, well... Yeah, I
retired.
I didn't know what to do, but MTN offered me a job. They offered me a marketing director, I think it was, and which would have been fantastic.
But Alan would have killed you.
I couldn't have taken it. I just couldn't have. I had no restraint of trade at Vodacom, by the way, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But I declined. I couldn't have worked with MTN after that.
Yeah.
But I did work with Cell C with the CEO at one time, Lars Reichardt.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes, he was fantastic, lovely guy.
Lars was great, yeah.
And we had fun. It was great to work with him and work there as a consultant to him for a couple of years. And then a few other small things I used. Some overseas companies who wanted to come into South Africa, I worked with them on finding BEE partners and helping them get into Vodacom. A couple of successes, a lot of not successes. It was very difficult, but that's what I did. And I called myself a venture catalyst.
Okay.
But I put deals together. I had a bit of fun. And then that was enough too. So then I quit.
But you've served on a number of boards as well. I think Datacentrics was one of them. You were on the CSR board at one stage.
CSR board, okay. Yeah. At one time, I think I was on about 10 different boards. I mean, it was that time when everybody was listing, and there I was out there as a public figure, and everybody, well, not everybody, but I got a lot of offers. It was ridiculous. I mean, you can't be on more than two or three boards. And I didn't stay on all those boards for long. But yes, I was on the CSR board, I think, for 2 years. It was interesting. And the best board I was on was the Datacentrics board.
Oh, was it?
And I had lovely time there. I was on that board, I think, for about 10 years.
Okay. Was that when Gary Morolla was running the company?
Gary Morolla, Ahmed Mohammed, wonderful people, wonderful group, wonderful company, really outstanding company, ethical, wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then I played a role there, I think, and then that was enough too, and then I quit there.
Okay.
And anyway, they got bought out, and I would have resigned anyway.
And Nuzala Investments, how long did you
stay involved? Well, I was there for quite a while as a board member. I think it's about 10 years also. And very interesting. We got a lot of deals because it was Black Empowerment. It was a women's group, one of the first. Very diverse, all races were there, and we worked together, we exchanged information, we did tech transfer of expertise, set up a foundation which is going today, which also does very good work. So that was my third bite of the cherry. The first was I think computers, the second was Vodacom, and the third was Nuzala, Black Empowerment. So, yes, I've had a few cherry, a big cherry.
Sure, sure. And you're obviously retired today, but what do you keep busy with these days?
Yeah. Well, I try my best to keep up with technology. I enjoy it. I'm always looking at new technology. Where I can use it, I do. I'm still mentoring a lot of women. Not as many as would like me to mentor them. I always say to them, if they ask me to mentor them, I'll do it. You don't have to listen to me, and I don't want you to pay me. And you don't have to take my advice. That's the main thing. And on that basis, I work with some women, and that's okay. And then I'm happy to transfer knowledge and assistance.
What do you think of the gender mix in the IT industry today?
You know, I'm not up to date on that. I'm a fellow, I think, of the, I don't know what it's called today, the Computer Society of South Africa, FCU, something or other. And I just keep in touch with what's going on. And I know there are a lot of women in the IT industry today, which there should be.
But there weren't in your day.
No, in my day, there were not. In fact, I had a car which had a license registration, which I picked. Oh, I must tell you one other thing. I picked up this license registration in America when I was there, and it said a woman's place, and then it had the number of the car, and then underneath it said, is everywhere. That was in my Joffe Associates day. But let me just say one thing that I forgot to mention, that when I was in the IBM phase, and when I brought these computers in, we really didn't know what to do. We had no sales material, nothing. I went to the US on a visit and to actually get some information. And I went to the IBM showroom in New York, which was on the ground floor, big with all IBM things there. And I went up to one of the salespeople and I said, Look, you know, I want to know about the IBM PC. Have you got any brochures, anything like that? Can you help me? And he said, look, you know, where are you from? I said, South Africa. He said, you know, there's a lady called Joan Joffe in South Africa who probably knows and probably can help you. So I just had to mention that because...
Did you tell him you were Joan Joffe?
I didn't.
You didn't?
Because I needed the brochures. Anyway.
Yeah. That's very funny.
Where did I get up to? Okay, so that was... Yeah, so then I finished my business career and I'm kind of... I'd say I'm retired and very happily retired. You know, I look at people sometimes and they're still in business and they're still in the industry and they're still competing. And I feel so fortunate that I can say, I don't want to be there anymore. I've done that. I'm quite happy. You can offer me anything you like. I'm perfectly happy where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great thing. I feel very relieved and very grateful that I've been able to get to this position.
Fantastic. Well, Joan, it just leaves me lastly to mention a few things that you haven't mentioned during the discussion today. You were a former Businesswoman of the Year. You're a recipient of the Wits University Lifetime Award for Entrepreneurship. You're a fellow of the Computer Society of South Africa. You did mention that one. And you're a winner of the organization's Fellowship Award for 2004. Joan Joffe, it's been marvelous talking to you, a real legend in South African IT. And it's been great to hear these wonderful stories about your career and some of the biggest events that happened in the local tech industry. So I thank you very much for joining me on TCS Legends today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Duncan. And I want to say that I'm really honored to be interviewed for this Legends thing. And it's always nice to talk about yourself. And thank you for giving me the opportunity.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us, Joan. Right. It's much appreciated.